Hey there, my name's Jared Holt, and welcome to Shitpost. This is a podcast at the intersection of tech, politics, and culture. Every other Monday, I bring on someone who I think is doing interesting work or has an interesting perspective. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on the player of your choice and check out the newsletter on Substack. There's a link to that and more in the description. What's up, Shitpost listeners? It's good to be back, let me tell you. Back with a new theme song, nonetheless, courtesy of DJ Danarchy. He did that remix. It sounds super cool, I think. So, big props to him. I'll be linking his stuff down in the description. On this episode, I'm going to be joined by Michael Edison Hayden of the Southern Poverty Law Center. His familiar voice on the show, a good friend of mine. I can't think of any better person to come back on the show as we return. Today, we're going to go through some of the headlines of all the stuff that I missed while I was taking time off from the show. Elon Musk made a bid for Twitter. What's his play? Ultra MAGA. How did a fascist aesthetic catch on in the mainstream? Paul Joseph Watson revealed to be just about as bad as everyone probably thought in some leaked audio. Crypto's crashing. Groypers are in disarray, and Madison Cawthorn is deep in the shit. All of those stories today with Mike Hayden. It feels great to be back. This summer is going to be a good one for the show. I can feel it. Here with Mike Hayden. Mike, what's up?
Hi, Jared. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you're a Mets fan, right? How are the Mets doing?
They're in first place, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
They were in first place last year, I believe, on June 1st. So we're not going to get too excited about things until we get past the All-Star break.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you came on the show this week. As soon as I went on break, shit just kind of hit the fan. And there were a whole lot of stories I normally would have covered on the show that I was just not recording anything for. So this is like the ultimate makeup episode. I can't think of anyone else I'd rather talk over some of these stories with. So let's just dive right in. First off, Elon Musk in April, seemingly as soon as I took a break from the show, Elon Musk started making these power plays for Twitter. The first thing he did was suck up a bunch of shares. He, you know, for a moment became the largest shareholder in Twitter, was going to get a seat on the board. And now he has an offer outright to buy Twitter and take it private, at least for a time being. The political right is cheering him on in this crusade, hoping that Elon Musk, with his epic Dogecoins and memes, will be the savior of big tech, reversing the shadow bans and censorship and smashing apart the woke tech. And to a degree, it seems like Elon is maybe like into this idea, or at least is enjoying this personification of him as that kind of figure. I mean, one of the first things he did was post like a Joe Rogan meme criticizing one of the top executives at Twitter. But that's about kind of as far as we know, I think. It's just, it seems like his plan changes by the day. The only really solid thing I've seen him come out on is saying that permanent bans are bad, and Jack Dorsey seems to agree with him. You know, he wants to bring back Trump. Seemingly unaware, there's this beautiful, luscious new platform called Truth Social out of beta testing now. I'm curious your take on this Elon Musk news. If we can really over-dramatize it, Mike, where were you when you heard that Elon Musk might be taking control of Twitter?
Well, I was, at my desk where a lot of this work gets done, and as I'm very embarrassed to admit, quite a bit of my work has to do with Twitter, right? Because it's like so much of this, so much of covering the racist right and covering far right extremism is seeing how they react to breaking news stories, because that's where they usually, that's where a lot of the investigations start, right? Is how they react to things that they get off of Twitter, which is why they're so obsessed with journalists and blue check people, et cetera. I think it's bad is the short thing of it, but I don't know, how much worse things really are going to be as a result of it, because of, the fact that Twitter has absolutely improved some things since. Milo Yiannopoulos and the 2016 election went down. But the site is still, very easy to exploit. And we saw that during January 6th, because so much of the promotion for it, and you can say like, okay, Parler absolutely played a role and Gab played a role. But really speaking, Twitter was the biggest hub for extremists to plan and execute what they did on January 6th. That's how they galvanized the most amount of energy. I don't know if you agree or disagree, but for me, the site is already broken. It's already got a ton of extremists that they couldn't get rid of. The fact that they were able to get rid of some of them in the aftermath of January 6th is a minor miracle, thinking of people like James O'Keefe. It's bad. I feel like figures would come along and exploit it in any case. Now it's just some of the old names coming back.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. Twitter is far from perfect. It does seem like at least some people in the company are trying. But they're really going against the grain of this sort of free speech fetishization that is really kind of foundational to the core of the platform and comes out of the mouths of people like Jack Dorsey, where, they just want to have everything and they want to kind of play both sides, right? They want to make money off the promotion of content, but then they also, if shit starts to go bad, they want to be just a neutral vehicle for content. And it just doesn't add up, really. So even against the best efforts of the kindest people that I'm sure work at Twitter and really do care about this stuff, and folks that I've talked to at the company through the years, it ends up being this kind of uphill battle. And a lot of the type of things that Elon has been talking about as far as, changes he would make to the platform kind of just strike me as winding back the clock. I mean, it's certainly not as bad on Twitter as it was. I mean, we were both in the throes of it in that 2016, 2017 era where just people posting, what they believed were home addresses or sending death threats like crazy. And it was just a very, very rough time to be on that website and to be a journalist.
So. I mean, we both dealt with that.
Yeah, and that has improved at least a fair bit, but to be this like free speech maximalist vision of a tech platform, it just, like, those already exist and they're not popular for a reason. Like, one of the arguments I've been making against what Elon at least says in a perfect world he would do with the company is that, content moderation and how little of it he seems to think should happen. It's not just, for safety reasons or for PR reasons. It also contributes to the user experience. And if Elon just shows up and is like, all the shitbags that got the can on here, they can all come back on and they can all do whatever they want. I kind of feel like it is, I guess it is financial suicide, right? If he has all this money tied up in the company and then he just destroys the user experience and makes people not enjoy the site. I just don't see how that ends well for him.
I think this is, yes, but I think this is like you're skipping over one piece of very important context that I think that needs to be highlighted here, which is that Musk is not only an extremely rich man who can absorb losses, he is an extremely rich man who's drawn scrutiny from the government for his financial activities and the things that he's done in order to make money. I mean, we saw some of the stuff that he did firsthand with Twitter to kind of jack up prices of cryptocurrency, or appear to do so deliberately. You know, I'm not making legal accusations here, but we all remember the Dogecoin thing, which culminated on his Saturday Night Live appearance, and just how that absolutely useless crypto, you know, spun up to gargantuan numbers relative to its value. And if you look at somebody like Trump, beyond the kind of things that we talk about and all the, you know, all the neo-fascist organizing that kind of sprung up around Trump's presence, the people who seem to be deep down most excited about bringing this guy back are people who just benefit from the lack of regulation or care from the government that happens at all. I mean, Trump wasn't even filling certain government positions. And I mean, it was basically a free for all for government officials. I'm not saying that Biden is necessarily like cracking the whip on rich people, because he's not. But I mean, Trump is basically, an absentee authority figure in some ways for the wealthy. And you get somebody like Musk, you know, he wants that world back. I mean, he wants as little scrutiny as possible on what he's doing. And, you know, I think rich people in general understand, very rich people understand, that they're going to benefit under Trump. And so let's say Twitter ends up being a loss for Musk in the end. Would he stand to benefit in other ways financially to compensate for that? I think they view Twitter and Trump as a way to just kind of tilt the world in the direction that they need to maximize their profits.
Yeah, my tinfoil take on this, and with the caveat, this is pure speculation, pure and probably revealing of my attitudes towards the ultra wealthy more than anything. But for all the incessant whining that people like Elon Musk do, or the God, what's that super rich guy who got tied up? Mark Andreessen.
I learned that Mark Andreessen blocked me after my crypto.
Oh,
after our crypto analysis with Megan Squire.
Oh man, he's blocked everyone. But between him, Elon, and I mean, just all of these insanely wealthy people, they won't shut up about like culture war stuff or like cancel culture stuff. And as I've talked about on the show before with other guests, you know, I think a lot of that boils down to is these are figures who believe that they should be celebrated for everything that they do, for the wealth they have accumulated. And Twitter is one of the few places in society where they aren't, you know, at least unanimously celebrated. It's a kind of a rare place on the internet where, you know, these ultra wealthy people are as addicted to the website as anybody else.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that don't like them that have a way to tell them that they don't like them that didn't really exist like 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah. I want to add one other thing to it that, again, we could spend all the time talking about Twitter, and I'm sure some listeners would be interested in that as well. But I want to just add one other thing is also Twitter is also like a funhouse mirror that kind of sometimes reflects the worldview of very cynical people in a way that they like. And I'll just bring in one example of that, which is the Post-Millennial, which is like this, you know, of course, a junk news publication. You've written about it and actually broke some significant news about how little they're paying their freelancers. It was $5 per post.
Terrible.
But, you know, like if you look at the Post-Millennial, we were looking a little bit at their traffic numbers. They're actually not very, very good, right? They're not particularly great. Not a lot of people are going to the website and reading their news. I mean, who are they? It is like just this, whatever. We remember, you and I remember when the site was first like sprung up, right? You just sort of came up and they verified it and whatever else. So you got this kind of low trafficked website that advertisers no longer want to associate themselves with. It is a website that people who are not on Twitter have never heard of. And yet that, you know, everybody who's on Twitter kind of knows what the post-millennial is because it is like ubiquitous on Twitter for whatever reason. It's just like this, it, you know, it is a website, a funhouse mirror that kind of, if you are a cynical, reactionary psycho, is going to show you exactly what you want all the time, which is why Jack Posobiec looks like this huge rock star on Twitter, just constantly doing incredible numbers. Now, it's possible there's automation there. He's been accused of that in the past. But I mean, there's some of it is organic. You do see him retweeted, you know, in the wild. And you know, he does a gig in Omaha, like a speaking engagement, and there, and it's got about 20 to 40 people inside an Italian place in Omaha, which has bad fluorescent lights. I mean, you can't really, you know, you can't really pack a crowd in. I mean, the average band playing at Brooklyn Steel or what's the name of the place in DC?
930 Club, maybe.
930 Club. That's right. The classic.
Great venue.
You know, are going to pack a far bigger crowd than if Jack Posobiec actually tried to exert his fame in real life. It's a funhouse mirror. And I think people like Musk, Andreessen, they really like that funhouse mirror. They like to live in that world.
Yeah. So maybe this is like, it's impossible for Elon to win or lose here. Like you pointed out correctly. So Elon could lose all this money and still have, you know, essentially what is a God power amount of money where you can just make things happen. Oh, I would like a skyscraper. Boom. Got one. You know, like that kind of money. So if he wins, these things about Twitter that they like can become more pronounced. And if he loses, he just stole, you know, the favorite toy of the news industry and like his most vocal critics. But that's enough on Elon and Twitter. I want to keep this moving along and talk about Ultra MAGA. You may have heard of this, Mike. On May 6th, Marjorie Taylor Greene updated her Twitter profile in the aesthetics of Ultra MAGA. There was a hashtag Ultra MAGA. You know, deep red, color toning, laser beam eyes. Laser beam eyes have been around, I mean, forever.
In various I knew it as activated eyes.
Yeah, it and what this is, and I feel like a lot of people were confused about it because they don't, you know, they have nice and normal, happy lives and don't do what we do all the time. But this is really just kind of a soft rebrand of something called Dark MAGA, which was a very like uniquely fascist aesthetic that was circulating on Telegram before Newsweek, your alma mater, had an article on Dark MAGA that I kind of like partially blame for this catching on the way that it did.
Newsweek.
Yeah, that it used to be great. What a magazine that's fallen. But they described Dark MAGA like this. They said, "Dark MAGA is a post-alt-right aesthetic that promotes an authoritarian version of Trump in a dystopian Terminator-like images." Sorry about that. So that's where the aesthetic came from. Then Joe Biden got up and gave this speech at the White House and used the term Ultra MAGA to describe the Republican agenda. And because they are, you know, happy, joyous little piggies who like to wallow around in the mud, the Republicans were like, damn right, Ultra MAGA. So we had this laundered aesthetic given a name by Joe Biden. And here we are. And this has been promoted. I was looking through some analytical tools. You know, you've got people like Jack Posobiec, of course, because he has his finger in every stupid thing like this. Sebastian Gorka, Kelly Ward, who's chair of the Arizona Republican Party, and good old Representative Matt Gaetz, all getting in on this Ultra MAGA thing. Right. And I was doing a photo gig over the weekend, you know, doing some photos at a synagogue, and I was texting you at the time, and I think you sent me the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing, and you were like, "Oh, hey, buddy, happy Friday night," and and especially just like where I was standing as I looked at that, I just got really, really bad vibes. I don't
know. It's terrible.
I don't know.
It's terrible. I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible on two levels, right? Like, it's terrible, one, because of where it kind of comes from and the origins, which is the sort of liberal scold aspect of it. Then it's terrible because it's just the absolute degradation of our country and our culture, and just how stupid everything is becoming. Yeah, I mean, it's terrible on that level too. You know what kind of interests me about it is I view the you know, this aesthetic, the activated eyes thing. I mean, like, what's the real statement of the activated eyes? Is this that I'm going to do something online and then I'm not going to apologize for it? That is kind of like the subtext of the activated eyes. It's just like, I'm really going to do it. I'm not going to engage in niceties. I'm going to really say this thing and I'm going to stand by it, right? It's almost like the same thing that the yes meme, where the guy, the side of the head thing, right? But it's like a more extreme version of that. And it's like,
and that's how the cryptocurrency people used it too. Right. It was like everyone saying cryptocurrency is this big scam, and it was laser eyes to be like,
I'm not backing.
Well, fuck you. Who cares?
Yeah. I mean, but it just shows you that like resentment in our country is like, has become like such a like currency. It's like that you want to advertise for resentment and cynicism. And it's like, there's no cool way to say that. I mean, I immediately sound square when the words are out of my mouth by scolding on, you know, on this, but like,
Mike Hayden just wants everyone to smile.
Yeah. More. I mean, it's true. It's not going to win me any followers for saying that, like, you know, I mean, that resentment and cynicism have become like this massive, currency, in our culture. And that's what the ultra MAGA thing really is about. It's just about like, you know, I am going to be an asshole or a piece of shit and I'm not going to apologize for it. And that's it. It's, you know, it's like Elon Musk. I mean, his performance online, you know, while getting this thing and sort of everyone on the right liking him because he's trolling the libs, is the same thing. He's like, sort of like, I'm a huge asshole. I'm a very rich asshole and I'm going to behave like a rich asshole. And by not backing down from that, by not apologizing, by not engaging in the kind of social niceties that a civilization not bent on self-destruction kind of engages in, this sort of, you know, by doing that, I am, you know, I am achieving maximum currency in our culture. And that's kind of like what this ultra MAGA thing represents. It's not coincidental that it happens at the same time that greed is running amok in our culture and the very rich are gaining more and more and more, because this really benefits them. More than anything else, right? Because if the main currency is to show that you're an asshole, then there's no penalty, social penalty for behaving like one and just hoarding all money for yourself. Sorry, it's not very nice assessment of where we're at with the ultra MAGA, but that is my that's what I got.
Yeah, so I think there's something to that. You know, this resentment being a driving force, but I also think it says something about where the Republican Party is at, to where it doesn't feel like it needs to feel embarrassed or, you know, like it doesn't have to. There was that phrase of like saying the quiet part loud. And it seems like there's this perception growing among the right that no part is the quiet part anymore. And who cares what people say? Let's just do it. And I kind of worry about what kind of things, especially in the wake of the Capitol riot and, you know, as we head into midterms, like what that kind of attitude will put within the realm of possibility for diehard supporters of these movements. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, a failure, like when we look at Joe Biden saying, haha, the Republicans are ultra MAGA. It's like, well, that's not working, Joe. Like,
yeah,
we could stop giving them catchphrases and like new things to call themselves. Maybe you could just like aggressively fight policy, or I don't know, stack the Supreme Court, or just, you know, play hardball. You know, Mitch McConnell coming out and saying, oh no, we would definitely kill the filibuster if we got power in the Senate.
Right.
And Democrats pretending like that's above board and stuff. It's just,
it's two
different games right now. And I guess I just worry that, you know, as many signals as there are, this ultra MAGA thing being ultimately, in the grand scheme, maybe an inconsequential signal or like a small signal of it, But this general shift, I think, has the potential to be, to produce results that would be really troubling if they came to bear.
Sure. Well, I mean, they're trying to win an election to get rid of future elections, right? I mean, that is the scary subtext of everything that's happening right now with the right. You know, I think there is this huge clash between the reality of Americans' everyday lives and also this kind of big picture issue of the Republicans trying to take authoritarian control of the country. Like, there was just a poll that was like, you know, where does inflation rank as your, you know, in terms of your most important issues? And I think it's like overwhelmingly, it's the most important issue for people. And, you know, in a normal world, it is for me, I will tell you, like, I mean, I spent a fortune on gas the other day, for example, and like, you know, I'm taking care of a family, right? So I'm dealing with these costs as well. And that's the kind of those type of pocketbook issues that you want, you know, for one thing, for the Democrats to actually start worrying about. But beyond that, it's just the kind of thing that most people deal with. They're not checked into the big picture ideology stuff that we are. They are looking to try to like just to put food on their children's plates and things like that. This it runs in conflict, of course, with the fact that the Republicans' grand plan seems to be to undo democracy as we know it and to sort of take one party control of the country. And that's what's really, really scary here is the fact that most people are going about their lives worrying about Thursday. And these people are, you know, psyching themselves in with this. I mean, now we're getting really deep on a meme, but they're really psyching themselves up for not only embracing January 6th, many of them already have, but embracing something far worse.
So the next story I want to go to is one you reported out for SPLC. It was on some reporting that was first done by the UK outlet Byline Times. And it's about this audio recording of Paul Joseph Watson, who, if you've been around the internet, you will know as the guy who goes, "Imagine my shock." I thought that was pretty good.
I think you got it wrong. It's "Imagine my shock." Like, he's got this, like, it's very musical.
Imagine my shock. Yeah, no. He used to work at InfoWars. He was like the guy under the wing of Alex Jones, but kind of came to eclipse Alex in a lot of ways with his own kind of audience. You know, Paul was, you know, more popular on Twitter, especially around 2016, 2017. He's got this big YouTube following. He's got, I want to say it's around or maybe even more than 2 million followers there.
I think it's just under 2 million. It's like 1.9.
So probably will be 2 mil eventually.
Yeah, it's going to be up to 2 mil. It's more than Tim Pool.
Wow, yeah. So in this audio recording, Paul Joseph Watson says a lot of terrible racist and awful things, and then says the line that he wishes that someone would, quote, "press the button to wipe Jews off the face of the earth." I'm not going to play audio. I'm not going to put the audio in this episode of the podcast for what I hope is obvious reasons. Tell me about this audio. Like, how did it come about? What do we know about it?
Yeah, so you know, when I think Byline Times, when they contacted me, they were like looking for someone to support them, because it's often very scary to, like, if you haven't, like, you know this because you're an old pro, but like, if you've never published a story about far-right figures, particularly ones with very big platforms, it can be really scary for people, because they're going against some, you know, they're kind of going against someone who has a big enough following to whip up a lot of trouble for you, like potentially harassment, threats, things like that. I mean, you know, again, like I said, we are old hat at this. We've we're quite calloused. You know, if somebody tries to you know, threatens me with murder or whatever, it's like another day ending with Y. But you know, they're looking for some support there, and also, you know, and you know, they I interrogated them about their sourcing, and I felt confident in the authenticity of the audio when they told me about it. And the other thing is also, I know Paul Joseph Watson. I haven't reported about him very much, but you know, as you know, my family is Arab, and you know, he plays particular. Yes, and also I have Indians in my family as well through marriage, and you know, he pays particularly strong attention to Arabs and Southeast Asian people. I mean, he's extraordinarily hateful towards them, but he uses very careful language whenever he does it, right? And I also knew him to use that triple parentheses, the echo, the anti-Semitic echo meme. We caught him a couple times doing that and just trying to see if he could get away with it, winking towards that. And also the other thing I knew about him was that Andrew Anglin repeatedly accused Paul Joseph Watson of, you know, taking content. I didn't have enough time to dig into Daily Stormer and find out where he did that. But I remember specifically saying like, hey, this was content on Daily Stormer. And now Paul Joseph Watson is mining it for my material. He's made that accusation quite a few times in the past. So I knew all these things about Watson. And I, for me, the audio was like, you know, well, this is, this is putting into like a literal way what we know him to be saying through his content before. So I, like, you know, it's not like I was like, oh no, he couldn't possibly have said that. Right.
Right. It, I mean, when I heard this audio, I thought, one, this is bad, but two, yeah, this seems about right for him.
Yeah. I mean, because he's British, and focuses on all types of global far right politics. And he pays some attention to the US, but he pays some attention to London. It's not like Stefan Molyneux, who rarely, he really did not spend a ton of time on Canada. He spent a lot more time on the US, really, if you think about it. So did Lauren Southern, for example, who is also Canadian. But Paul Joseph Watson does spend some time in London. And, he, you know, in some ways, it's easy, but there's so many things to cover that it's sometimes easy to just be like, okay, he's England's problem. But when this came up, I mean, it was an immediate reminder of just how awful, you know, some of his content has been through the years. And also, this is a very important thing, when something you would probably remember very, you know, in a very concrete way. When all these InfoWars personalities started to go, and they really started to go, Watson somehow rebranded and you know, created his Summit News or whatever, and stay, and was able to stay online. And he was absolutely part of that. I mean, he's, there's not anything that should make him any better or different than Owen Schroyer, who's also got his own connections to white supremacy, or any other InfoWars personality. And Facebook, to give them some sort of credit, is one of the few that actually got rid of Paul Joseph Watson.
So what I think is interesting, aside from the audio itself, is what has happened afterward, which is really not a lot. And I think that's kind of huge. You know, you have somebody on tape using racial slurs, anti-gay language, saying he wants to wipe Jews off the earth, or I guess literally what he said was he wishes someone would do it, not that he wants to do it. And Paul has not addressed it. None of his allies, you know, the folks like Jack Posobiec, Mike Cernovich, the Info Warriors, no one has even acknowledged that this audio has come out. And if an organization, like say if Breitbart wrote a piece, or actually I have a perfect example of this. One time Gateway Pundit wrote an article that said that I used the N-word to describe the leader of the Proud Boys. And my immediate reaction was, are you fucking kidding me? Why would I do that? And
did they really do that? I didn't even
know that. They did. And you know what I did? I got in touch with old Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit and gave him a piece of my mind for a minute. And they took the story down. So it's, you know, it kind of just kind of seems like the type of thing that if it's not true, if that is not you in the recording, you know, or if those, or if it was, you know, if you thought it was a joke, or if he didn't mean it or that he would want to say something about it. But I feel like the silence has been very damning in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, you know what? He, Byline Times told me, you know, when they were telling me about how they reported it out or whatever, they took pains to not only contact him and reach out for comment, but they also reached out to his lawyer in the UK. And because now remember, defamation laws are much more stringent in the UK. And that's part of the reason why I was convinced of its authenticity right away. I mean, they took a lot of time. They didn't do what we did, which was we were sort of like, hey, we're going to publish a story in a bit. Do you guys want to say anything? We had to do that because we're going on the back of their reporting. But they reached out with a significant amount of time in advance, gave them days, you know, I think better part of a week, in fact, and with repeated offers. And again, to his lawyer. Now, a lawyer is like that. Then it becomes an issue where it's billable for Paul Joseph Watson. So if they had something to say where it was not him, then I would be pretty, you know, I would have expected someone to have said something. And of course, they didn't ultimately. And, you know, regarding this, nobody saying anything, nobody doing anything. The only thing that could really happen from here is that YouTube would suspend him for being a racist. Or Twitter would remove him for being a racist. And there's all this Elon Musk oriented. It's good that these stories are all lumped together, in fact, because there's all this Elon Musk related energy around, you know, anti-censorship and free speech. Now it's, you know, any kind of major suspension would create a huge dust up. And there's, they always have to worry about the possibility of Elon Musk weighing in or something like that. So that is action I did not anticipate anyone doing anything about. And then regarding Watson, I think he's just calculating that if he can just hang back and not say anything, nothing's going to happen. The last thing I will note about this is I am getting increasingly used to how SPLC is effective, you know, and in order to appreciate it, in order to feel assured of our success in things, I have learned to be patient in the sense that, like, for instance, you report something about Nick Fuentes and you report some more things about Nick Fuentes. And then, you know, a year later, you start to see cracks in his organization and things like that, because nobody wants to initially give you credit for what you're doing, because you work for SPLC and on the right, everyone is calls you a communist like organization that is like bent on this and discredit the SPLC. If you remember during RNC in 2020, I think their like only platform was that not to take SPLC seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean that if anything should tell you that we are a threat, that is to how they organize. That is the fact that they, you know, it's so big on people, weighs so heavily on people's minds. What I would say about this is, yeah, Watson is going to carry on, but he is in a difficult place now. For one thing, which is that if he makes news of any kind, this is already out there.
Yeah, yeah, it will
and
be.
He's not denied it, and he's had plenty of chance to deny it. So
it will be all of his citations on stories will be Paul Joseph Watson, comma, who was captured on audio saying, yeah. So yeah,
and he's also a person. Sorry to interrupt. He's also a person, and this is a big one. This is a big factor that people are now, when they associate with him publicly, are making the choice to do that. They understand, like, okay, this is the guy who was on the Eliminate All Jews thing. They're going to be in a photograph with him at a party. They're going to be speaking with him at a speaking engagement. It puts a tremendous amount of tax on his ability to organize. Now, he may look at this and say, look, that's fine. I'm just going to lay back and keep YouTubing about modernity or whatever. But in order to sustain your audience, those type of social engagements are very, very important. So that is my last word on that.
And with that last word, we've got a few more stories to click through here. Crypto is crashing. I don't have money tied up in crypto anymore, and I'm happy I don't, given how that's been going. I've been trying to read a lot of analysis on this. A lot of it's like pretty wonky in the way that crypto blogs and reports can be. The coins, so many coins, some are stable, some are not, some are something called Binance is happening. No, but a lot of the analysis I've been reading kind of points to the Federal Reserve's hikes in interest rates, sort of kicking this off. You know, a hike in interest rates would discourage what would be perceived as a risky investment most of the time, like cryptocurrency. A lot of this has also been kind of agitated with, you know, some big sell-offs of Bitcoin. And that being the leader kind of influencing the rest of the pack. And then probably the most like absurd one, which is the collapse of a very prominent stable coin, which a stable coin is like another kind of cryptocurrency. It's like a Bitcoin, but its value is pegged to fiat currency or legal currency like the US dollar, which is
right. You it's used when people are particularly for like when people trade frequently, then you can move your crypto from one crypto to the stable coin temporarily. Well, and then you move it to somewhere else. So you're kind of getting it off a hot plate because crypto is so unstable.
Yeah, and this is also used by these crypto markets to try to instill some kind of confidence in it from the government, right? And then one of these stable coins just collapsed. There was a period today where I think it's called Luna. I'm going to misremember this. Maybe it's Luna, Terra, something like that. Anyway, one of these things that's supposed to be pegged to the dollar started trading for less than a penny. And I think it's really caused some shockwaves. I don't know if it's too soon to say that this like dream of cryptocurrency might just be dead, but this has been very brutal. Over at DFR Lab, some of us were looking through some of these crypto investing like subreddits and stuff. And, you know, I don't say this to be funny. I don't want to like kick anyone when they're down, right? But it's pretty gutting stuff to read, man. People are posting suicide hotlines, expressing, you know, oh, my life savings was tied up in this, and now it's who knows what's going to happen here. And I just wanted to bring up this essay that Hamilton Nolan wrote. I want to think it was at the beginning of the year about how, you know, a crypto crash, he argued, was kind of all but inevitable, and then when it happened, that it would radicalize people. I want to read a quick passage from that. Here is what will happen when hundreds of thousands of younger investors are smashed by the crypto crash. They will be radicalized. This will not be experienced as simply a decline in prices, because crypto represents much more than a simple investment to its most fervent adherents. It represents a way out of the American trap. It represents the existence of opportunity, the possibility of economic mobility, the validation of the idea that you, a regular, hardworking person without connections, can go from the bottom to the top, thanks to nothing but your own savvy choices. When that myth is shattered, disillusionment with the American system will follow. Unfortunately, given the realities of the moment, these newly disillusioned and radicalized and angry and broke people are far more likely to turn to fascism than socialism. So I was kind of reminded of that essay as I was looking at this news and watching crypto crash. And as far as politics go, I definitely think this would probably drive most of these investors further to the right rather than to the left. Even just sort of what we were talking about earlier, you know, the presence of resentment and anger as a operating, you know, cultural currency and sort of taking king of the marketplace of ideas, if you will, right? And the potential that if this crash doesn't rebound, that, you know, that pool of upset, disaffected people is just going to grow and, you know, kind of open the doors or or not even open the doors, but just kind of like set the stage for bad things to happen. Because there's certainly a lot of people, we talk about a lot of them on the show here, who are very eager, chomping at the bit to try to exploit people in those spots and use it to drive towards, you know, unjust and unfair outcomes.
Well, I think Nolan's very smart, and I think that's very, I really enjoyed the piece. But I just want to say, I don't think it's like in stone necessarily that it would move everyone to the right. Mm. I think we may be headed towards, you know, a very serious recession. And right now with the Democrats in power, it absolutely does feel like that would be the case. But you got to remember something important, and this is hardly a this is not like an optimistic take I'm going to give you. If they strong arm their way into power and take and start to really take an authoritarian control, like in Hungary, some folks will definitely be all in on supporting that. I actually think we could actually be a lot more dangerous and a lot more scary than Hungary because we're America. They are at the same time undoing all these things that we've come to know as norms in our society that are social issues, potentially LGBTQ rights, the right to have an abortion, et cetera. All these things are happening at the same time. So in cities, if the vibe is, if it really feels like one party rule, the Republicans will be the ones who are struggling to govern people who have no money and have no hope. So that is the only other side to that. But I do understand what he's talking about, because like as of right now, we are dealing with a very weak, it feels like a very weak liberal hold on these very people who are losing their money.
I also think it's important on the flip side of that coin, and this is something I think I saw you point out on Twitter, which is that if we're going to talk about, you know, whether people get radicalized towards the far left, the far right, the far right's been fascinated with cryptocurrency for a long time. They use it to shuffle money around. Yourself and Megan Squire have done really excellent reporting, including on somebody who dropped, you know, what I guess at the time was $2 million worth of Bitcoin on Alex Jones.
It's a lot. It's about a now less than three quarters of that in value.
Yeah. So, I mean, Alex Jones cashed it out pretty much as soon as he got it.
Well, he didn't necessarily cash it out. He moved it. That's all we know. We don't know if he turned it into, we don't know if he turned it into US dollars. We know he moved it. Huh. And I think one of the theories is that he moved it to a Coinbase account. So we don't know if he kept it there, if he pulled it out, or what he did exactly. I assume that he's very concerned because of the possibility. Once we detected it, then it becomes fair game for the Sandy Hook.
Yeah. So, you know, as these markets crash, some of these folks who, you know, operate in these sort of seedier ways and use cryptocurrency to help themselves do that, they are probably feeling the hurt as well, too. I don't think it is the main story of the crypto crash by any means, but in the interest of exploring the other side of the coin there, I did want to bring that up.
Well, I just want to, just one thing I wanted to add to that. I am not countering what Nolan's saying. I have a different pessimistic take, which is that we find ourselves within a few years under one party authoritarian control, and then at that point the Republicans are going to have their hands full, and I really believe they are governing, because they need these cities, they need New York, they need California, they quite frankly they need Houston, right? Like this is a liberal stronghold right now. They need these places, and they also want them to shut up and do what they say. And as we saw in the summer of 2020, they don't necessarily have what it takes to kind of control this population. I mean, like, people burnt down a police station and everybody's like, Trump, do something, you know, all the people on the right. But there's limits to what they could actually do. And if you could imagine a situation that is where the economy is shakier and the anger is three or four times as high, their ability to govern strikes me as being weak. So we are in interesting times already, and I think it's going to get much more interesting. And economic problems, are a big part of that. I'm still holding my Ethereum.
Diamond hands, Mike. So we got two more stories on the docket here. This one will probably be pretty quick. Last weekend, some associates of the white nationalist podcaster Nicholas Fuentes, who now has an extremist file on SPLC that is worth reading. That's very well done. Jaden McNeil and Sam Dickerman, they went on this podcast hosted by pieces of work is like the diplomatic way to describe these guys, right?
Andy Worski.
Oh yeah, just visibly high the whole time.
And I just want to say, as I described Andy Worski to Hannah, my colleague, I said Andy Worski is like the number one guy you would not want your daughter to like introduce as her boyfriend.
Anyway,
that is the way I would describe it.
So Jaden McNeil, Sam Dickerman, they go on this podcast called The Kino Casino. Fun name, at least, I guess. I guess. I don't know. I don't actually know what it's supposed to signify. But they go on the show. They say all kinds of things about Nick Fuentes, some of which are pretty substantial, some of which are outright funny and just like fun little tabloid bits of gossip that we don't normally get to hear out of these movements. Some of the more serious allegations, Jaden McNeil said that Nick Fuentes had been lying about having $500,000 frozen by federal authorities while they investigate him and his finances. Fuentes said, unfortunately, I did sit through the like 4 hours of Fuentes complaining about the podcast I'm talking about. Fuentes said that he couldn't explain whether or not the assets are still frozen, but they are under investigation. But Jaden was saying, oh, no, that's, he's had that money available to him for a year, bought this expensive car with it. So that's definitely more serious. Another thing that I may or may not have an article coming down the pipe about is an allegation that Cozy TV, the streaming platform that Nick built for him and his buddies, is juicing up the view counts on the public-facing thing. The proof that Jaden and Sam Dickerman, put forward as proof of this didn't really satisfy me, but there may be an article to read about that next week. We'll see. And then, of course, some of the funnier allegations, which is that, Nick Fuentes got mad when Jaden McNeil got a girlfriend and searched his room in the house that him and Nick were living at with a black light looking for cum on the furniture. I was going to try to say that and keep a straight face. I couldn't do
it. It's tied in with this idea that Fuentes is engaging in control of his followers, like sort of like controlling of their sex lives and things like that. It has cult-like characteristics. And the words that I believe Simon Dickerman, who is, has done a lot of important to Fuentes work, for America First. It's a big defection. I believe he called it a homosexual death cult is the words that he used. And we should just say that, we are not interested in what Nick Fuentes' sex life is like or what he, who he's attracted to or what he does. That is not our business. Hypocrisy is obviously an important issue. And these are very, very homophobic people, and they particularly target gay, bisexual men, trans women. Whatever it is that is going on there, it definitely sounded to me like it had the characteristics of a cult. And then Fuentes had responded by making people take a pledge.
He was like blasting music, raise your right hand, take the pledge, which seems to I'm less interested in Nick's sex life if I'm interested even one little grain. That's his business. Don't care. But the point is exactly what you were saying, this environment of control And for Jaden McNeil, who was, by all accounts from the outside, one of Nick's closest associates, and Sam Dickerman, who, you know, has had this sort of behind the scenes, less publicly visible, but, you know, very involved role with Nick for some time. You know, these are pretty serious defections. You know, this isn't just some like random person in Nick's Discord server or some intern that Nick had saying, wow, this guy's a piece of shit. You know, these are guys that really got to know Nick for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal. McNeil is, you know, for people who don't know him, is sort of like Fuentes' number one sidekick, is the way I would describe him. He's really kind of his, he's been his like hype man, his like side guy. He showed up when I went to the Vax Watch event in New York City. He was there kind of to provide support. He's like a, you know, a supplemental figure in the movement. And then Dickerman, we ID'd him in part as participating in part of this kind of alt tech team that moves between InfoWars and America First and Epic, the domain registry that has been linked to a lot of Nazi sites. And he's kind of a lifer in the movement at this point. Like he was, you know, we first saw him around 2017 appearing with different white nationalists. And, you know, kind of latched on to America First. And the reason why people like Dickerman are so important is they will do the work. They will do the organizing work. If you think about, like, for people who are familiar with like kind of left-wing organizing work, it's like, yeah, it's all good to be like, I'm a socialist, or like do a socialist podcast, or like troll whatever liberal and be like, oh, I'm dunking in liberal. But for the people to show up and organize, right? The people who show up at the meetings and do the difficult work of like, okay, we need to get a candidate in, or we're going to knock on doors, whatever, right? Those people are few and far between. A lot of people are just online. And Dickerman is one of the kind of people who will help you accomplish things and get things up. And America First PAC was a big deal. I mean, it's a very impressive accomplishment for a white nationalist group in some ways, because it's like you're getting sitting Congress people to show up at this thing. Even if it was this abhorrent and often clownish production, it was making a very big impression on young white nationalists. It was getting their attention, and you need people like Dickerman to pull those things off. So for him to bail, and for one of his number one sidekick figures to kind of bail on him, is a bad sign for Nick Fuentes. And it follows a lot of troubling news. It's like, we've ID'd a lot of his, with a lot of people around him who preferred to remain pseudonymous. And, you know, he is also under investigation. He says criminal investigation, he says, and he's also been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee. So, you know, as we saw with the Charlottesville guys, these guys can burn very bright, but then once they cross a certain line, a tremendous amount of scrutiny falls on them, and then it's very difficult for them to kind of get off the mat after that.
So we've got just a few minutes here. Gripers in disarray. We'll continue to keep an eye on that and see how that shakes out. The last thing I want to talk about, but not too long, because I feel like this has already got way too much attention as is the leaks coming out about Madison Cawthorn. The Daily Beast describes it in this way, in the lead-in to an article they wrote about sort of where this is coming from, and I couldn't come up with a better way to describe it, so I'm just going to read it. Multiple embarrassing traffic stops. A credible accusation of insider trading. Photos of him sporting hoop earrings and a bra. A video of a male staffer's hand near his crotch. Another video showing him jokingly but nakedly humping the upper body of potentially the same man, his cousin, and possibly more to come. Oh my God, dude. I don't know if I've ever seen like an oppo dump as aggressive as what's going on with Madison Cawthorn, but a lot of the Daily Beast reporting on this kind of points not to, you know, Democratic operatives dumping this, but rather just this really fierce standoff in North Carolina politics. A lot of the state's GOP wants Madison Cawthorn the fuck out of his seat. And, you know, whether it is Cawthorn's comments about cocaine orgies happening on Capitol Hill, or, you know, comparing Zelensky, the leader of Ukraine, to a thug and a criminal dissenting from sort of the party line there, It's just, it's been so wild to see, and I've really tried not to get too caught up in it because, I mean, it's for the same thing as we were talking about with Fuentes. Whoever Madison Cawthorn is attracted to, whatever he does sexually, I don't care. I don't care at all. I've known how I've felt about Madison Cawthorn. As soon as I saw that reporting about him being like the vacation of a lifetime, I went to the Eagle's Nest and walked the same halls that Hitler walked. Comments. Yeah, yeah.
Well, as somebody said, I can't remember which reply or whatever, but one of the pictures where he was, you know, kind of on femme or whatever, someone said, "You're trying to make me like him," whatever. I mean, like, that's what I thought. I was like, well, this is the first time I've ever looked at this person and in a favorable light. So please don't try to make me like him. But, you know, I think that one thing that this story highlights for me, and that is a reoccurring theme that we've touched on before, going back to the ultra MAGA stuff, and then we were talking about kind of undoing democracy and that sort of thing, and the questions of like what happens after crypto crash. And the right repeatedly has shown a willingness to be absolutely ruthless with no limits all the time. And you know, and we saw elements of this, if you recall, in when George W. Bush ran against a John McCain, a much more like liberal friendly John McCain type, you know, version. He was really going for the centrist vote and the Straight Talk Express, whatever. I mean, I think somebody, was it Rove or whatever, planted the suggestion that he had fathered a child out of wedlock that was from a mixed race.
Yeah.
Something like, I mean, it was just like crazy.
It's called push polling.
And I mean, this new version, this Trump era version, whether they're taking on their own kind or they're taking on our country itself, never mind people they consider to be enemies, seem like they have just absolutely no limit ruthlessness. And like, if they're trying to get rid of Cawthorn, looks like this is an example of that.
Yeah, totally agree. We're picking up on some themes today. Well, that's all I've got on my docket today. Mike Hayden, thank you so much for coming on the show and going through some of these stories with me. I can't think of a person I would rather do it with. And you've been on the show plenty of times, plenty of times. You know my last question. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Okay, I like I don't know if it's cringe to cite Action Bronson, but I would say my favorite thing on the internet right now is the line in from his new album, which goes, I'm in a tree like you can, I'm in a tree like a black, you can find me like in a tree like a black jaguar, or you can find me in aisle three of Pathmark buying my son a Matchbox car, which is, I think, my favorite line. It's so sweet, and it's got such a kernel of truth to it, and as an old man, I identified with it the minute I heard it, and it is something that I encountered online. So that's it. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's cringe. I'm just gonna say,
if it's cringe, everyone go find Mike on Twitter. I'm gonna have a link to Mike's Twitter, to some of the recent stories that he's bylined. You can check that all out in the description of the episode. Mike Hayden, thanks for coming back on.
It was my pleasure, Jared.
You can find me in a tree like a black jaguar. Or an aisle three at Pathmark, about to buy my son a Matchbox car. My performance like Aaron Donald at the combine. Love and hate, there's a fine line. Should I let it go? No. Or turn him to a wonton? You'll be gone long time. I'm positioned at high ground, covering the shore. Your bitch got a face like Pauly Shore. It takes forever to put a long 44 out my shorts. I don't give a fuck if you're 500 pounds, you're getting tossed up. Bitch, I'm all high and sourced up. I put 5 Corvette engines in a Porsche truck.